Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
So I'm Dr. Teal Phelps Bondaroff, he, him. I am the Director of Research for Oceans Asia. We are a marine conservation organization that works to combat illegal fishing. And our focus of late has been a lot of work on shark fins. And we had a paper come out recently on seahorses. And one of my areas of expertise is crime in sea cucumber fisheries. I think I can humbly say that I am one of the world-leading experts in sea cucumber wildlife crime. There's only about 8 of us, and a couple of them are my health research assistants, but it's exploring people who are engaging in illegal activities within fisheries relating to sea cucumbers. And what I found with my work, which I think is quite interesting, is we find crime at every stage of the fishery supply chain, from people forging fisheries documents to people fishing illegally out of season in illegal areas with illegal gear, using human rights violations on vessels, forging papers, smuggling sea cucumbers, lying about places of origin, etc. And one of the fascinating things is I've been looking at sea cucumber crime around the world, and a lot of my work is focused on a couple of hotspots. India and Sri Lanka is a major hotspot. Mexico is another one, the Galapagos. And recently, our research team has been looking at sea cucumber crime here in Canada. And we had a paper come out earlier this year that found that there weren't a lot of major cases in Canadian history. You've got mostly small administrative cases dealing with people who forgot their licenses on the day of. And the largest fine in Canadian sea cucumber crime prior to this recent story was $21,300 with no jail time for someone who was engaging in some, you know, criminal activity around sea cucumbers. But typically they're administrative crimes, which throws this current case into stark contrast. Today we are talking about the largest sea cucumber crime case in Canadian history, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks for being here with me, Teal. We have spoken previously, and if people want to really get into the nitty-gritty of what is sea cucumber crime and that sort of global holistic perspective, you can go to cgsf.ca. The episode is posted there. But as you mentioned, there is a local BC case that is making news because the sentencing was just announced. And as you sort of foreshadowed, it sets a new mark in terms of the level of fines and the consequences for sea cucumber crime.
Yes. And so this case is a case involving a gentleman named Scott Steer, who is a notorious poacher. And I didn't realize this until I was reading the court filings, but apparently he has the longest record of Fisheries Act violations in Canadian history. And this is a man that since 2008 has been on the radar of the authorities. Fisheries and Oceans Canada opened a file on him in 2008. They've opened 15 different files. And since that time, he's had 34 convictions in 13 prior cases. And these are everything from crab fishing to other fisheries violations. There was issues around illegal harvesting, issues around defrauding other vessel owners. There's probation violations and a whole host of crimes. And this is quite an interesting and high seas adventure story. The background is in March 2020. Some folks on a ferry saw a boat without its lights on fishing at night. They reported it to DFO. DFO gave chase in a high-speed sea chase. Someone, Scott Steer, threw his cell phone off the side of the boat with all the evidence in it. Divers 3 days later went down, retrieved the phone, and were able to recover information about his criminal enterprises, and they charged him on 8 counts of various violations of the Fisheries Act and violating previous prohibitions. Just to underscore how notorious this gentleman was, he was prohibited from stepping on a fishing boat until 2038. So one of the crimes that he committed was violating that prohibition. But now we finally had the sentencing this past Friday in Nanaimo, and the sentencing was significant. You know, in the past, he's received small fines and some short jail sentences. The sentencing was 6 years in prison and a $1.1 million fine. So it's very significant in that way. And what was really interesting Well, some of the wording from the judge, the judge said at one point that they need to move him as far away from the sea for as long a period as possible, and that only incarceration will prevent him from inflicting further harm on the scarce public resource of the fisheries. This is someone who's unrepentant, who was actively fishing illegally and selling illegal fish products during his trial. And so, yes, we do have sentencing in this case, and it's quite a significant punishment.
What does it mean to you as someone who is sort of invested in the topic of marine wildlife crime to see this level of punishment?
Well, it's really, gratifying, because far too often the punishment is really a small fine, and that's just worked into the cost of doing business. You see ships coming ashore with millions of dollars of illegally caught fish in their holds, which they then can sell and make a profit, and their fine is less than the cost of fueling the vessel. I will say that the jail sentence is significant. I would have liked to see higher fines, only because his company was selling illegal sea cucumbers to the tune of $1 million. So I would have liked to see even greater fines that were more punitive, but really this is a significant series of fines, and this is what the prosecution was asking for. So it's nice to see that the court was really listening and saying, no, this is what's needed to protect our oceans. But yeah, far too often the punishments really do just become, the cost of doing business, and that really undermines governance on the high seas. One of the reasons I think that is largely because we treat crime targeting the environment, and specifically the ocean, often as an administrative crime. Slap on the wrist. Ah, boys will be boys. And it's often always boys, of course. There's a very gendered nature to sea cucumber fisheries. But these are crimes, right? If someone was stealing $1 million of lumber or from a bank or from a local business, that would be a very significant crime. But this happens on a regular basis at sea, and people are simply given a slap on the wrist. Well, here we see a case where that's no longer the case. And here's someone getting serious jail time for having a dramatic impact on our oceans.
So do you hope that future potential sea cucumber criminals or sea wildlife criminals will see this verdict, the sentencing, and maybe pause?
I hope so. I mean, one can hope, right? When you follow the judgment, the judge did not seem very convinced that this sentence would have an effect on Mr. Steer's behavior. As you said, he's been unrepentant and continually poaching time and time again. But my hope is that anyone else looking at the sentence will kind of raise an eyebrow before they consider, stealing marine resources and damaging our oceans. And I will say that out here on the West Coast, from our research, we haven't found as many cases. This is an outlier. Most of the cases are administrative. Out on the East Coast, it was often people who forgot their license on the day of, and that's a small fine. And they just need to produce their license. So we have a relatively well-regulated fishery. But one of the challenges we have as researchers and investigators is we don't know if we're not seeing cases reported in the news and being, picked up by the law enforcement authorities, whether that's because there aren't any cases or because the criminals are being very shifty and effectively hiding their operations. So it's always one of the challenges in our business. But these are global networks as well. So the sea cucumbers aren't being sold here in Canada. They're moving through Canada, but they're ultimately heading off to Southeast Asia. And we see globally fishers sending, and middlemen sending, sea wildlife products to places like Shenzhen in Hong Kong. And that's, there's a global network. And one of the big risks that we see in other jurisdictions is what's called serial exploitation, where fishers will exploit one area, devastate it, and then move on to the next. And that has a devastating effect. So my hope is that this has a stifling effect on anyone considering poaching sea cucumbers and other marine wildlife, for that matter, out here on the West Coast, because we don't want to see people just moving on to slightly, more prolific pastures where there's less law enforcement and then impacting our oceans.
Right, and you've sort of touched on this in your previous answers, but obviously someone facing criminal consequences for this criminal behavior is good, but what would be better would be just sort of preventing the crime in the first place. In your opinion, what needs to be done to make strides in that area?
That's a really good question, and I think it just relates to ongoing enforcement and monitoring and governance. Out here in Canada, we have relatively good governance, as I mentioned, so I think that's quite reassuring. But I think the international supply chains is where I'd like to see a lot more action. One of the big risks that we see is something called fish laundering, where people introduce illegally caught fish from one market into another, where they're then laundered to become legal products, using air quotes here for the radio purposes. And that's a huge problem. And so you can actually see products like those that Scott Steer was stealing from our oceans can be introduced into legal markets through these different fish laundering tactics. And so that's something I'd like to see more work on. And the other one is international cooperation. Our work looks at these international networks And we often find, not here in Canada, less so, but in other jurisdictions, the people most being arrested are poor fishers, not Mr. Steer in this case, but they're poor fishers. And the middlemen and the endpoint sellers who are making all the money aren't the ones that are being arrested. So one thing I'd like to see law enforcement do is a lot of international cooperation to wind up these networks, because the real risk is that you arrest, you know, poor fishers, and the middlemen and the buyers just find other poor fishers to exploit, and they continue their operation. It's the middlemen and, you know, the people who are the kingpins in these networks that need to be taken down, and that involves international cooperation because it is transnational trade.
And is there anything else you think people should know, either about this case or about sea cucumber crime or marine wildlife crime in general?
I think there's a lot. I mean, I've literally written the book chapter on this topic. So if folks are interested, please go check that out. But to me, it's the importance of understanding that wildlife crime targets a wide range of species. I think when a lot of people think of wildlife crime, they think of elephants and tigers and, you know, charismatic megafauna, typically terrestrial, sometimes sharks, dolphins, seals, and those kinds of things. But what they don't realize is there is a vast global market for what I guess you would call obscure species, whether it's sea cucumbers or caterpillar fungus or seahorses or bear bile, a whole wide range of wildlife products that people haven't even heard of. And one of the risks that happens there is that people haven't heard of these products, and so they're more easy to transport across borders. Border security is looking out for guns, drugs, people, and, you know, well-known wildlife products, but they're not looking out for a suitcase full of fish maw or a swim bladder. And a suitcase full of fish maw can be worth $1 million. And so there's a lot of opportunities for law enforcement to step up their efforts to combat these less well-known species. And it's really important that they do, because what we're beginning to see is a lot of organized crime syndicates are diversifying their portfolios into wildlife crime. When we were looking at crime and sea cucumber fisheries in Mexico, we found cases where sea cucumbers were found alongside drugs. And our worry is that you see things like narco ranching, where illicit crime networks are investing heavily in these wildlife products as a way of moving large amounts of money across borders and as a way of diversifying their portfolios. And that's a huge risk. But I will say this much, the people who are engaged in a lot of wildlife crime of this nature aren't often as smart as the criminals who are smuggling guns, drugs, and people. And as a result, it's often easier to wind up their networks. They're not as security conscious. So it's an opportunity for law enforcement as well. So I think we really need to be aware of the breadth of species that are targeted by wildlife trafficking and step up to do something about it.
Great. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, always a pleasure chatting.
This is Bird Note. Near the center of Delhi, the capital of India, there's a three-story pink building that serves as an unusual type of hospital. Not for people, but for birds. It's called the Charity Birds Hospital, and the institution is over 90 years old. At Charity Birds Hospital, a small staff takes care of approximately 2,600 birds at a time, providing antibiotics, medicine, food, and a safe place to rest for injured or sick birds. Dr. Harafdar Singh, the lead veterinarian at the hospital, says the majority of the birds in the hospital are pigeons, but they also take care of parrots, kites, vultures, and peacocks depending on the season.
Sometimes I feel it's me. I think these birds are thankful to me.
A big city like Delhi can be perilous to birds. Dr. Singh notes that fans in the summertime can trap them and children's kite strings slice into their wings. But anyone can bring a bird to Charity Birds Hospital, where they are cared for, completely for free. The hospital is run entirely on donations, mostly from the Jain community, which follows the philosophy live and let live. If the bird does recover, they're brought to the roof of the hospital, where they're given food, water, and other necessities. And at the very moment of their choosing, they take a flight, a free bird again. For Bird Note, I'm Tricia McCurdy.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Are you looking for a quest this summer? Well, the North Shore may just be the place to visit. Recently, North Van Arts, which is the Community Arts Council of North Vancouver, released an app called the North Shore Culture Quest, which serves to gamify exploration of the North Shore's notable sites and locales. To learn more about how this app came to be, as well as how it can be used for questing, we traveled to North Vancouver's Lonsdale Shipyards, where we met with Anna Lynch, the executive director of North Van Arts.
Yeah, so back in 2020, the North Shore Culture Compass, which is a website with an interactive map, was first published. It was a project that had been in the works for a long time beforehand. And basically the map lists cultural points of interest for all of the North Shore, so that's West Vancouver and North Vancouver. And the reason behind creating it is multiple reasons, but one of them is to support having archival collections and research around different cultural hubs and points of significance, like public art and heritage trails. But it can also be used to plan trips, find new events and places to go, and discover new cultural organizations or pieces of art. So really the website itself is twofold. When the website was launched, one of the ways to promote it, because it came out during the COVID-19 pandemic, was to create treasure hunts. And the treasure hunts were originally PDF scavenger hunts created to get people to explore different areas that were listed on the Culture Compass. Since then, we've decided to develop the treasure hunts into its own app, which is our new North Shore Culture Quest app, which gamifies finding different locations and clues so that you can learn a little bit more about the cultural history and heritage of the North Shore and find some hidden gems along the way.
If you think that the North Shore Culture Quest app has any similarities to other popular virtual game apps that require you to go outside, you wouldn't be the only one.
Internally, we've already been referring it to as a cultural Pokemon Go. So it's the same kind of idea, and we're definitely getting quite a lot of downloads, not just from local residents, but from people all across Metro Vancouver who are, you know, coming across to the North Shore for the day and looking for something a little bit different to do. The plan is that we're going to release different quests each month in different locations. So we have neighborhoods listed across the North Shore to help keep it fresh and relevant and give people something to come back to each month.
At the end of our conversation, we asked Anna Lynch if she could explain one of these quests for us.
Yeah, so one of the first quests that we launched last month is called Around the Shipyards, and all the clues, there's six clues in and around the shipyards area, so it's great for those who are just coming across on the sea bus or getting down here by one of the local buses. And that one is going to be permanently on the app, so it can be played at any time.
Seeing as how we were already at the Lonsdale Shipyards, we asked Lynch if she would be open to going through the Lonsdale Shipyards culture quest with us. She agreed, and our journey commenced.
So we need to head to the main entrance of the Lonsdale Quay Market, next to Quayside Plaza. Look up. Can you see the 18-meter tall Quay Tower? It was designed so it would be visible from downtown Vancouver. Just opposite on the plaza, we'll find some flagpoles and maybe, if we're lucky, a street performer. How many flagpoles are there? All right, let's go.
So then we walked to the entrance of the Lonsdale Quay Market, where we counted the number of flagpoles that were in front of the building.
Okay. So our flagpoles, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it says, take the last letter of that number for your clue. So the last letter of 5 is E, so E is our letter, and then we submit.
We uncovered a clue in the form of a single letter. We continued to uncover clues throughout the shipyards until we reached our final objective, which required us to locate and take a photograph of a historical site within the shipyards.
head to the location, open your camera, and line up the image. So for the photo-based locations, you'll see a location on the map, but you can also see how far away you are. So right now we're 95 meters away, and it says you're not close enough yet to take your photo. Head a little closer. It helps put you in the right direction. It also stops people to be able to cheat by doing them at home. So we're 45 meters away, but we're able to take a picture. So let's press take photo to see what I'm looking for. So this is what the original picture was.
At this point in the quest, each task completed has unlocked a new letter, and we're about to find out that once all of these tasks are completed, you're given an incomplete sentence, one that you can now complete with a word formed by the letters you've unlocked.
There we go, we get confetti, and we have the letter G. So now we should have all the letters for our code word. And the clue for that is the shipyards district is a place, great place to something, to have fun with your friends and family. Let's see, do you have any idea?
I did not have any idea, but thankfully I was provided a hint that made the answer much clearer.
Ah, okay, I think I know it. So, G-A-T. H-E-R, gather.
There you go. Great. So we have completed our first quest.
And with that, our quest was completed. And while there are only a few other quests to complete at the moment, there are over 1,000 points of interest on the Culture Compass map, with new quests coming monthly, according to North Van Arts. For those interested in the North Shore Culture Quest, the app can be found on the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. From Mexico to Mongolia, Sweden to South Africa,
many, many, many people across the globe are feeling the effects of extreme heat that is fueled by climate change.
Roop Singh is at the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, which co-authored a report about global extreme heat from May 2024 to May 2025.
We found that 4 billion people, about 49% of the global population, experience at least 30 additional days of extreme heat due to human-caused climate change.
And in many areas of the tropics, people saw more than 100 additional days of extreme heat, that is, days that are hotter than 90% of the temperatures historically observed in the local area. Extreme heat can be deadly, but Singh says cities and countries can help protect residents, for example, by educating people on how to stay hydrated, increasing access to air conditioning, and developing early warning systems for heat waves.
This threat is here and now. It's not really a future problem. It will continue to get worse, but there are tons of actions that we can take to reduce the impacts.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
But I didn't request
it. Liver disease affects 1 in 4 Canadians.
It doesn't come with a warning. It doesn't wait for the right moment. It can happen to anyone at any time. While liver disease may be part of your story, it doesn't define it. Liver Canada is here for you before, during, and after diagnosis. Find resources, support, and hope at liver.ca. Liver Canada, by your side at every stage.